Hello, everybody, and welcome. We are back here on the premiere for another week, for another movie. And this being the month of October, we're going to have a theme here on the show. For this month of October, these shows will strictly be about horror movies. And we'll pick and choose what we want. We're going to start the day off this week with a more artsy, I guess, horror movie, a more renowned classic in terms of horror movies, not much of one of your slasher fix. So on the premiere with me, DJ Jazz, tonight, we're going to be talking about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. The Shining came out in 1980. It's based off of the novel by Stephen King. It's a psychological horror film. It stars Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, Danny Lloyd plays the young kid, and Scatman Crothers plays the cook, which has a key role in the movie. And the novel was actually written in 1977, so the movie came out 3 years after the novel came out. Kubrick's previous works had kind of spread by word of mouth. It was more small-time shows at small-time screenings, and then people would hear about them from friends of friends and then go see them, and they would eventually turn into these profitable movies. The Shining was actually released as a mass-market film. It was released in two cities on Memorial Day and then nationwide a month later. And it refers, the title, The Shining, refers to what Scatman Crothers' character named Dick Halloran refers to as this ability that he and another character, Danny, the young boy in the story, share. And it's this telepathy, and they're able to talk to each other without speaking, even from large distances. They know facts about people before they even meet them or before they even tell them about themselves. And they're very sensitive to other sort of supernatural or otherworldly forces and energies in the area, which is why in The Shining, if you've seen it, Danny becomes under attack by these forces in the hotel. These supernatural forces target him as a result of him having this extrasensory ability. So the plot, if you've never seen The Shining, once again, we're going to do a spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen The Shining. It's a very good movie, especially if you like horror movies, so I recommend you watch it. But a spoiler alert anyway, even though it did come out in 1980. So Jack Torrance, which is Jack Nicholson's character, has to interview for a job as a caretaker of the Overlook Hotel. And the Overlook Hotel is in these mountains 25 miles out from town in Colorado, and it's closed October to May. So from October to May, they need someone to watch the hotel, make sure the pipes don't freeze, make sure all the wiring is kept up to code, just to make sure that the hotel doesn't break down, so that then when they open it back up in the winter time for skiers, everything is ready to go. He takes the job because he was recently fired. They go into this more in the book of why he was fired, and he found the location perfect to work on writing a book. At the time, Jack Nicholson's character is trying to write a novel. The previous caretaker, though, the owner of the hotel warns that the previous caretaker by the name of Charles Grady had actually developed cabin fever and went on to kill his wife and two daughters and then himself. So he tells him ahead of time that this job can take a toll on you, and if you're not careful, the isolation will really get to you and screw with your head. So he warns him very early on about this. Meanwhile, in Boulder, Danny Torrance, who is Jack's son, who is played by Danny Lloyd, a child actor, has this vision that has since become a pretty famous scene, and it's known from The Shining, of the elevator doors in the lobby opening and all this blood pouring out of the elevator. And it's a really intense shot because every time you see it, it's in slow motion. It's not fast. So you just see the doors start to slowly slide open, and then all this blood just comes pouring out. And most of the time when you see it in the film, it goes all the way towards the camera almost, and sometimes the blood will actually engulf and go over the camera. So the shot, when you see it, is really intense. So he sees this while he's in Boulder, and Jack's wife, Wendy Torrance, who is played by Shelley Duvall, calls a doctor because Danny has sort of fallen into this trance that he has since come out of, but she still calls the doctor just to make sure that he's okay. And when he's in this sort of trance, he seems to refer to an imaginary friend of his by the name of Tony. And that sort of alter ego of Danny's comes around later in the story as well. Jack Torrance has actually lost his previous job in the novel. Like I said, they go into it. He was a teacher, and he had problems with alcohol. And when he was drunk, an upset student came up to him about some grade and confronted him, and he was shoving him, and it got out of hand, and Jack Torrance actually ends up fighting the student and beating him pretty bad, and so he's fired from his job at teaching, so he needs to take up this job as his caretaker to support his family. So another reason that Jack has really given up drinking is there was a time when Danny was out in front playing, and he had come home, and he was upset and drunk, and Danny ran up to meet him, and Jack grabs his arm to move him out of the way, and when he threw him out of the way, he actually dislocated Danny's arm, and it almost broke up their family. Wendy almost left him, and it was really hard for Danny to sort of come back from that and be close to his father after, you know, something that traumatizing. But they're sort of on this recovery stage when the story starts. So when the story actually begins, they're still really shaky and sort of stressed by these newfound problems that's coming across them. And this job as a caretaker almost seems like too good to be true, which unfortunately it eventually is. So Jack has since been sober, and he hasn't had anything to drink. So when they get to the hotel, they're showed around by a character, the cook, named Dick Halloran. And Dick Halloran is the character who's played by Scatman Carruthers. And he speaks to Danny using this telepathy. And Danny, since he's been alive, has not known anyone else to have this power that he's got, this ability to sort of speak to other people or look inside other people's minds. And before he even speaks to Danny using this in the film, he's talking to Danny and he's like, "Oh, would you like some ice cream, Doc?" And the mom and the dad look at him and they're like, "How did you know that? That's a nickname we use for Danny." And he goes, "Oh, I heard you call it, you know, call him that when you guys were getting out of the car." But in reality, they never said it. And he was able to see that by taking a peek into their minds using this ESP or this telepathy. So when they're alone, they eventually do get ice cream. When they're alone, Dick explains to him that he's not the only one that's able to do this. There's plenty of people who are able to, and it sort of comes in various strengths. Some people will just be able to read people very well. Some can full-on guess people's backgrounds without even talking to them, and then some have this very strong ability to be able to talk to each other without even speaking, such as Halloran and Danny both have. And he says that he calls this shining. That's what Dick Halloran's grandmother called it, because his grandmother also had it and taught him early on about how to use it and how to what it was, this ESP, this telepathy. But he also warns Danny that places can shine just like people, and that the hotel, the Overlook, has this shine along with the many bad memories that have taken place there. And Danny, actually, before Dick even mentions anything more about the hotel, asks about a specific room, room 237. And Dick seems a little startled when he hears this, but he goes, "Look, there's nothing to fear about room 237, but I still don't think you should go near it." So even though there's this sort of cryptic warning that he gives him, Danny agrees and he says that he'll stay away. So time goes on, about a month passes, and Jack has just hit this writer's block. He's set up a typewriter in the hotel lobby because there's lots of space and there's the big open windows, but he can't write. So he's spends his days throwing a rubber ball at a wall and kind of taking his rounds around the hotel and checking up on everything, because he really can't think of anything to write. Wendy learns they have a two-way radio at the hotel because it gets snowed in during the winter, so people get stuck there. And they need some way to communicate without the phones, because the phones go down due to the heavy snow every year. So they have this two-way radio. And while this is all going on, Danny is still having all these visions. He has the visions of the elevator again. He has this vision of this word red rum
REDRUM, which he can't explain. And he has, there's another famous scene where he's riding his big wheel, his tricycle, through a hallway, and he comes across these two girls, these twins in the hallway. And they say, you know, come play with us forever and ever. And he gets this flash of them killed then in the hallway, and blood all over the walls. And we find out later that this is these psychic flashbacks that Danny is sensing of the horrible things that have happened in the hotel. And these two girls are actually the two girls of the former caretaker who were killed. And while this is all going on, Jack is just slowly starting to deteriorate, and he's just acting very on edge, and he's very quick to anger. Wendy comes up to him at one point to ask, how are you doing? Do you need anything? And he snaps on her, and he cusses at her and yells at her and just tells her, you know, why don't you just get out of here? And, you know, all she's doing is asking him, you know, you want something to eat? Are you okay? And he just blows up in her face. So he's starting to just not be himself anymore. And at this point, Danny actually finds room 237 open, and he decides to go in. And it cuts away for a moment, and it goes to Jack at his typewriter, who's asleep. And he wakes up from sleep screaming. And Wendy runs up to him because she hears it. And when he's on the ground because he falls out of his chair, he's actually drooling. And he looks a lot almost like an animal. And he says he's had a nightmare that he killed Wendy and Danny. And he was like, it was so real. I don't know, you know, what that means. And he's very flustered. And so Wendy is trying to console him. And at this point, Danny comes up with bruises on him. And he didn't say anything. He's kind of traumatized. And so Wendy immediately assumes it was Jack, because who else is in the hotel? Just the three of them. So she blames Jack and takes Danny to make sure he's okay. And meanwhile, Jack actually wanders into the Gold Room, which is like the hotel's ballroom and bar. And even though it's the bar, everything is gone. All the liquor's gone. All the chairs are put away. It looks as though it's closed for the off season. So when he sits at the bar, he looks around and sees there's nothing there. And he says, I'd sell my soul for a glass of beer right now. And when he looks up, he starts talking to this character named Lloyd. And when the camera turns around, there's actually a bartender standing there. Lloyd, the bartender, is played by Joe Turkel. And so he has this full-on conversation with this guy who in no way possible should actually be there. They're the only three in this hotel, but when you watch the movie, just all of a sudden there's this other actor behind the bar, and the whole bar is filled with liquor, and he begins to pour him drinks. So at this point in the movie, you just get really shocked, because it's just, this all seems to appear literally out of thin air. So he just goes into this tirade of just complaints that he has about Wendy and Danny. And meanwhile, Wendy finds him and says that Danny actually said that a woman in 237 tried to strangle him. And so Jack thinks, okay, that's impossible. We're the only people here. So he goes to check it out, and he finds this woman in the bathroom, naked woman, and he follows her into the bathroom, and she closes the shower curtain behind him, behind her. And when he opens it up, there's this old, rotting corpse woman in the tub, who then starts to get out of the tub and chase him out of the and walk towards him and eventually chase him out of the room. And he's so traumatized by it, when he gets back to Wendy and she asks, you know, what happened, he says he didn't see anything. So while this is all going on, Danny is stuck in this trance like before, but he's not coming out of it, and he's only referring to himself as Tony, and he's speaking in this different voice, this more rougher, kind of back of your throat type of voice. And so it's really establishing the fact that he's a different person. And so Wendy and Jack are arguing over whether they should take Danny to get a doctor. And meanwhile, Danny actually calls out using his ESP to Dick Halloran, who is on vacation in Miami, I believe. So think about that. He was able to, because Dick Halloran warns him before he leaves. He says, if something happens, use your ability and shout to me. Shout as loud as you think you can, and I'll try and hear it. So when he's in Miami, Danny does what he's supposed to and yells, And when he yells, it actually causes Dick to fall to the ground and grab his ears, because he thought that even though Danny was strong with this ability, it would be impossible for him to be that strong. But we find out from this warning call for help that Danny is actually extremely powerful with this second ability that he's got. So he calls for help, and Halloran immediately gets on a plane to come back. And so we're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we're going to finish up with the last half of the movie and the exciting end in the movie. But for right now, you're listening to Penguin Radio. I'm DJ Jazz, and this is the premiere. Everybody, we're back here on the premiere with DJ Jazz, and we were just getting into this more second half of The Shining, a good movie by Stanley Kubrick. So at this point, Danny has called for help, and he's still stuck in this trance, but Jack actually goes back to the Gold Room to find it full of people and decorations and band music, and once again, it's just a scene that should not be in this film, because in all reality, they're there by themselves. It's just the three of them. Yet there's this huge party. So the audience is kind of left to wonder, how has this party just appeared out of nowhere? So while he's walking through, a drink is spilled on him by a butler, and he takes him into the bathroom to clean it up. And when he does, he finds out that the butler's name he calls himself Delbert Grady. And if you remember, the caretaker from before, who the owner of the hotel had warned Jack had gone nuts due to cabin fever, his name was Charles Grady. So the Delbert Grady, which is in this bathroom, he's played by Philip Stone. He's very cautious about him at first, and Jack actually confronts him, saying, you were the caretaker here. You went insane. You killed your family, and then you killed yourself. And he looks at him, and he goes, I'm sorry to defer with you, sir, but you're the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker. And he says, I should know, sir. I've always been here. And then there's just this standoff where they're staring at each other. And it's this interesting moment, because it's almost like he's trying to manipulate Jack to fall even further, to sort of just question his sanity and question whether he really is the caretaker or not, whether he really does belong in this hotel or not. So Grady then warns Jack that Danny has contacted Halloran, and this only makes Jack even madder. He sees Danny as being disrespectful, and then he connects it to his mother. And Grady says, you know, I had the same problem with my family, but when I did, I corrected them. And so that's him referring to when he actually just went out and outright killed his whole family and then himself. So at this point, Wendy wanders into where Jack has been writing his story and finds the manuscript on his typewriter, and it's just full of pages that only say, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, in different fonts, in different formatting, but it all is just the same line. So at this point, Jack walks up, and she's actually got a baseball bat, which is smart thinking on her part. But Jack walks up, and she confronts him and says, we need to get out of here. We need to leave. And Jack threatens her and says, oh no, that's not going to happen. So she knocks him unconscious and locks him in the freezer. And so Wendy goes to try and escape with Danny, but Jack has actually disabled the radio and the snow cat. The snow cat's just this big industrial car, basically, that or with treads that's meant to get in and out of heavy snow. So he's disabled them both. And at this point, Jack wakes up in the food locker or the freezer that he's been locked in, and he starts talking to Grady, who is supposed to be on the other side of this door. His voice is just coming out from the other side of the door. And Grady says, you know, I'm disappointed in you. I thought we understood each other when we last talked. And Jack goes, you know, if you let me out of here, I promise you I'm going to be a man of my word. And at that point, the door is actually locked. There's like a sliding bolt. And then the door just unlocks. The bolt unlocks, and then the door opens. And Jack is let free by a somewhat invisible force. So Danny, while Wendy's asleep because she needs sleep after dealing with her day, Danny wakes up and goes to the door and writes red rum on the door. And he starts saying it out loud. And then as he's saying it, his voice changes and he comes out of the trance. And Wendy wakes up and she sees the word reflected in the mirror, and the word reflected in the mirror spells out murder. And at this point, Jack starts to come through the door with the axe, and she's able to get Danny out the bathroom window before she barricades herself with a butcher knife. And this is where the famous "Here's Johnny" scene comes from. He chops down the door, says, "Here's Johnny." And then at this point, Halloran actually shows up to help, but he's killed by Jack in the lobby. And then he sees Danny and chases him outside into the hedge maze, which is outside the hotel. And Wendy is running through the hotel trying to find Danny. And she comes across the lobby, and the lighting changes to like this purple blue. And it's just full of skeletons all dressed in these suits from their different time periods. She's hearing roars and screams come out of the halls. The blood from the elevator scene plays again. And then she eventually comes across Dick Halloran's body in the lobby. So Danny, who's being chased by Jack at this point through the maze, he's actually smart. There's snow, and so his trail, Jack is just following his trail of footprints through the snow. So he wipes away his footprints so that they lead to a dead end, and then he backtracks through his footsteps and then hides in the hedge maze, the wall. So Jack comes to this dead end, and then he kind of just starts going through random routes in the maze, and then Danny's able to follow his trail of footsteps and just escape. So the ending is actually Jack becomes lost in the maze while Wendy and Danny escape, and he eventually collapses just from exhaustion, and then he freezes to death that night. They show him in the morning just frozen. And the last shot of the movie is a photo in the lobby that's dated July 4th of 1921. And when they zoom in on the photo, Jack Nicholson is actually in the photo at 1921 at this ball. And so you're kind of left with this question of, was that him, or did the hotel absorb or consume him? It's an interesting shot that they decided to actually end the movie with. And we'll be going over the different interpretations of what that shot means later in the show. But right now, we're actually going to get into the cast and just how they were picked for their roles and how they were picked for their roles. So Jack Nicholson plays Jack Torrance, who is the father of the family, and he didn't get any Academy Award nominations or recognitions, but it's still remembered as one of his most famous roles. And he was Stanley Kubrick's first choice, but Stephen King, who had written the novel, he wanted it to be played more of by an everyman, a guy that you would just see on the street every day. Because Jack Nicholson he's a great actor, but he's also very eccentric and animated. So Kubrick won the argument, but some of the other actors they had considered was Robert De Niro, for example, who actually said the film had given him nightmares for months after he saw it. And two other people that they thought about were actually Robin Williams and then Harrison Ford. And that may have been interesting, but it would have been really weird just to see them in that part, knowing now, or seeing the movie now with Jack Nicholson. He does such a phenomenal job. You wonder how different the movie would be if it was taken over by one of these other actors. So Nicholson always appeared in character on set, and Kubrick encouraged him that if he knew his lines well enough, he should improvise. And he actually improvised the "Here's Johnny" scene, and where Wendy discovers his novel, the "All Work No Play," that was improvised. What he says in that scene, and Kubrick was picky in terms of directing, which is really interesting that he would give Jack Nicholson this power to give him this power of improvisation, because he was really picky. In fact, the scene that they did with Lloyd at the bar was shot 36 times before they decided it was fine. So Shelley Duvall plays Wendy Torrance, and Nicholson says Kubrick was really great to work with, but he was a different director altogether when it came to Shelley Duvall. And they would argue constantly on set over different things, over the script, over the shots, over just whatever they seemed to find to argue about. And the extended time of filming really put people on edge. It took a long time for them to finish filming. In order to give the movie the more psychological horror it needed, Kubrick actually intentionally would antagonize his actors if he knew there was an important scene coming up. And he intentionally argued a lot with Duvall on set, and he would isolate her when she went to read her script. They filmed the scene where she is defending herself with the baseball bat about 127 times. And at one point in filming, Shelley Duvall was actually so stressed that she went up to Kubrick with clumps of hair that had fallen out from her hair or from her head from the stress of filming. Danny Lloyd is Danny Torrance, and he's a small-time child actor. He hasn't been in much else since The Shining. Kubrick actually sent a husband and wife team, the husband and wife were Leon and Crisetti Vitale, to Chicago, Denver, and Cincinnati. And they made an interview pool of about 5,000 boys over a 6-month period to try and find a kid. And the reason he chose these towns, because Kubrick was looking for a kid that had an accent that was somewhere in between Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall's accents. They had sort of different ways of speaking, and he wanted to find a combination of that. So the reason they picked Danny Lloyd is because he could really maintain concentration for extended periods of time on set, which really isn't common amongst child actors. So Kubrick was able to film all his scenes without Danny Lloyd actually realizing he was in a horror movie. When he was older, he actually revealed that he thought he was in a drama about a family in a hotel. So he was unaware at the whole time that they were filming this horror movie. Scatman Carruthers is Dick Halloran. So Scatman Carruthers is actually a jazz musician, and he's known for scat singing, which is Scatman Carruthers. And scat singing, if you've never heard of it or heard it, it's just sort of improvised vocals, and they're just meant to go with the rhythm of the music and sort of accentuate the music. And he got the name after he worked on a radio show in 1932 in Dayton, Ohio. The director didn't think his name, Benjamin Carruthers, was catchy enough for the radio. So Carruthers came up with the name Scatman, and then it would eventually work his way into his music career. He played for a lot of famous people, including Al Capone, who was a famous gangster at the time. And then he eventually moved to Oakland in 1948 with his band, and he played piano at the Portocal and Waltz 405 Club. So he was more of a musician, but he was in a few films, and the one he's most known for is The Shining. So for the production, when the film actually started, Kubrick had directed a movie in 1975 called Barry Lyndon. And it was a highly visual period film about this Irish man who was going up against aristocracy. And despite a lot of its technical achievements, it was a box office flop, and critics had called it too long and too slow. So he set out to make a movie that was going to be commercially viable and then artistically interesting to watch. And so he had his staff bring him stacks of horror movies to his office to read. And Kubrick's secretary said she would hear him just books hitting the wall as he was throwing them across the room into the reject pile. And she noticed one day that she hadn't heard that thud against the wall in a while. So when she went to check on Kubrick, he was actually reading The Shining, and he was really engrossed into it. So he decided to run with The Shining. And he got in touch with Stephen King early on, and they came to an agreement over having equal participation in the film. And so Kubrick built multiple sets on sound stages at EMI L Street Studios in Borehamwood, which is in Hertfordshire, Britain. And he made these multiple sets so that he could shoot the movie in chronological order, and so that if they made any changes during the filming, which there were a lot of, they could just transition from set to set much easier. They wouldn't have to cross state lines or anything like that. So the set of the Overlook was actually then the largest ever built on the soundstage at Elstree. And it had a life-size recreation of the outer exterior of the hotel. And then some of the interior designs were based on the Ahwahnee Hotel, which is actually in Yosemite National Park. So the exterior shots were mostly shot on set, but the opening shot, which is a Beetle, which is the family's Beetle driving to the hotel, was shot in at St. Mary's Lake, which is Wild Goose Island, which is in Glacier National Park in Montana. And they would also use the Timberline Lodge, which is in Mount Hood, Oregon, around 1979. And in the spring of 1979, due to massive lighting used by Kubrick, the set actually burst into flames and then destroyed much of the building, and then it had to be completely rebuilt. So that was a major blunder for Stanley Kubrick to have to pay for and rebuild this set and this building that he had just destroyed. Another reason that The Shining was significant is it was among the first half dozen films to use the Steadicam. And the Steadicam is this stabilizing mount, and it separates the camera operator's movements from the actual camera's movements. And so it gives you this smooth tracking shots, even though it could be on an uneven surface. And so the inventor of the Steadicam, Garrett Brown, was actually heavily involved with the production. He visited the set and was really inspired by seeing all the different options and opportunities to use the Steadicam. So Brown signed on and said later that Kubrick was using the Steadicam as a tool which can help the lens where it's wanted in space and time without the classic limitations of the dolly and crane. So it gives you these wonderful shots without having to worry about moving slowly and making sure you hold your breath so it doesn't shake the camera. So as I said before, the filming itself took a long time. Principal photography actually took over a year to complete. And this was due to Kubrick's really methodical and meticulous nature. He wanted everything to be done perfect. So the script changed constantly, and actually it would sometimes change several times in a day. And Jack Nicholson eventually got so frustrated, he would always throw away the copies the production team would give him, because he just said that, they're going to change anyway. And he would learn most of his lines just minutes before they shot these scenes. Joe Turkel, who played Lloyd the bartender, actually said in 2014, they had rehearsed the bar scene for six weeks, and they would start at 9 a.m. and then they would finish at 10:30 p.m. And his clothes would just be soaked in sweat at the end of every day's shoot. And he actually added that even though it was a rigorous process, that's actually his favorite scene in the film. So for the final gold room scene where Jack actually meets Grady, Kubrick told all the extras in the room to mime their conversations instead of actually speaking. He had seen that from old films, when people mime their conversations or mime like they're talking to each other, they tended to use large gestures that look fake and nod and kind of give this overall sense of being over the top. So it gives, when Jack walks in from this empty hallway in 1970 to this packed ballroom in the roaring 20s, it really has this sense of realism, and just it's crazy to see the time shift from 70 to 20. And the way they shoot it is you see him walk into the ballroom from the empty hall, and the camera transitions in with him, and so the wall passes, and there's a second where you just see the wall, and then you actually see just the ballroom, and it's full, and you can hear the music blaring, you can hear people talking, you can see people dancing. And it's one of those moments again in the movie where all this shouldn't be here, but it appears in a split second, in the blink of an eye, and it really just stuns the audience in their seats. So for the overall theme of the movie, Kubrick says, there's something inherently wrong with the human personality. In all of us, there's this sort of idea of we all have the potential to do bad, or we all have original sin, and we all have something inherently wrong, and there's an evil side to it. And one of the things that horror stories are able to do is show you these horrible, evil sides of people without having to actually confront it directly. So when you're watching a horror movie, you get to see the more darker parts of human nature without having to confront it. And this is, to Kubrick, more of the theme of the movie. You're getting to see both sides. You know, the beginning of these characters is they're just a regular family. Yes, they've been through some troubles in the past, but they're maintaining a nice family values and they're trying to stay together. But as the story goes on, Jack really falls into this evil, twisted being, almost monstrous. Like I said, when he's chasing Danny through the maze, he doesn't even talk. He's only like yelling and slurring his words and kind of drooling. And at this point in the movie, he's got a lot of facial hair and he almost looks just like this animal chasing Danny through the maze. And that's another theme of the movie, is sort of this changing of a perfectly good everyday man into this animalistic beast who's now chasing down his own child, trying to kill him in this maze. So it's just interesting to see this transition on screen. And an interesting fact actually was the door, which Jack Nicholson chops through and says, "Here's Johnny." That door is actually real. They had substituted it for a fake door, but Jack Nicholson had actually once in his life been a volunteer firefighter. So he chopped down the fake door within a couple of seconds. So they eventually took it off and then replaced it with a real door. And then the line, "Here's Johnny," along with being improvised, is actually a play on the intro Ed McMahon would give Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And it was improvised, and Kubrick had actually been living in England for some time, and he hadn't seen the show and didn't really know the significance of the line. So he actually almost used a different take for the final film and decided against it at the not at the last second, but he decided against it, thinking that it was a really cool shot and it was something improvised that he really liked about Jack Nicholson. And Johnny Carson would actually later use the shot of Nicholson going through the door and saying, "Here's Johnny," to open his anniversary show on NBC in 1980. So we're going to take another break real quick, and then we'll get back to The Shining. You're on Penguin Radio, listening to The Premiere, and I am DJ Jazz.
I'm not like that. Trying to remind her. When we go back, I miss the last bus, we take the next train. I try, but you see, it's hard to explain. I say the right thing, but act the wrong way. I like it right here, but I cannot stay. I watch the TV, forget what I'm told. Well, I am too young and they are too old. The joke is on you, this place is a zoo. You're right, it's true.
All right, everybody, we're back here on The Premiere talking about The Shining, and we're going to talk about when the movie came out and its initial reception right now. So it started slow, gained momentum in the box office as the weeks went on, but it did really well commercially in the summer of 1980, and it was able to make Warner Brothers a profit, finally. And this was mainly due to mixed reviews when it came out. There was one by Variety, which had stated, With everything to work with, Kubrick has teamed with jumpy Jack Nicholson to destroy all that was so terrifying about Stephen King's bestseller. So they had really torn it up in the reviews. And so it just didn't get a lot of people going to see it right away. It was actually the only one of Kubrick's last 9 films to receive no nominations from either the Oscars or the Golden Globes. It was nominated for 2 Razzie Awards, which are these joke awards, which are specifically meant for bad films. And it was nominated for Worst Director and Worst Actress in the form of Shelley Duvall. And it was actually nominated for both in the first year that these awards were given. More recent analysis, they've treated the film more favorably. The initial criticism of it was slow, which was really typical of horror films at the time. But this, when you look back on it now, people have realized that this slow, sort of drawn-out story is what contributes to the film's suspense in total, and this sort of hypnotic quality it has. It draws you in. So Stephen King has actually been quoted as saying that although Kubrick made a film with memorable imagery and it was impressive, he feels it was a poor adaptation of his book, and it was the only adaptation of his novels he could remember hating. However, in 1981, in a nonfiction book he wrote called Dance Macabre, he listed Kubrick's filming The Shining. He considered it to contribute something of value to the horror genre, and he mentioned it as his personal favorites. So Stephen King kind of went back and forth on whether he liked the movie or not. When he wrote the story, he was suffering from alcoholism at the time, and he was sort of disappointed the film didn't really portray this disintegration of family and the dangers of alcoholism that actually played a large part in the novel. And he also saw Nicholson playing Jack as a mistake. He argued the audience would actually realize too quickly that he would go mad because Jack Nicholson had played a character in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest who was actually from an insane asylum. So Stephen King suggested they should have a more everyman. And some of the names he threw out for Jack Torrance were John Voight and Christopher Reeves, which would have been funny because Christopher Reeves, if you don't know, is the original Superman from back in when the show was on and the first movies came out. He's the original Superman. So seeing him go down this crazy path might have been actually kind of funny to watch. But the reason he wanted this more everyman instead of someone like Jack Nicholson is so that the character's subsequent demise and spiral into insanity would be more unsettling and more shocking to the audience. And so at the end of the day, the movie is actually left open to interpretation because there's lots of imagery in the movie and there's lots of themes and interpretations that they actually will subtly put into the movie. And so one of the first ones that is brought up a lot is the fact about how much the Native Americans play a role in The Shining in the film. In the movie, the Overlook's actually built on a Native American burial ground. And while they're going through the hotel, the owner states that when they were building the hotel, they actually came under attack a couple times by Native Americans. And if you watch the movie and you really pay attention, there's Native American logos and symbols seen throughout the movie. They'll show Indian head logos on baking powder in the pantry, and they have lots of patterned artwork in the hotel. When Halloran dies in the film, he's on one of the rugs that has one of those patterns in it. And the blood from the elevator that pours out is supposed to be symbolistic of the blood of all the Native Americans that was spilt there. And then at the end, the date of the photo, July 4th, is meant to be slightly ironic due to that fact. Another thing that's brought up, or another topic, is the debate on whether what Jack is witnessing and seeing around him is ghosts, or is it the result of cabin fever? So cabin fever, if you don't know what it is when a person is confined and somewhat isolated by themselves or with a few people for long periods of time, it makes them stir crazy. It makes them want to get out, or it makes them sort of just slightly go off and become mad. And it's just this theme of isolation that can really get to you. And so in sequences and scenes where Jack is speaking to these ghosts, he's almost always in a room where there's a mirror, and he's almost always talking to the mirror. When he's in the pantry, he's talking to the door where Grady is supposed to be on the other side, but the door is polished, so you can kind of see a reflection. And from that point, it causes you to wonder whether he's really talking to these spirits, or is he just talking to a reflection in the mirror, and then we're seeing his sort of insane projections on screen. And also, Jack looks into the mirror whenever he's speaking to the hotel, as these ghosts are a result of the hotel. And to some extent, this implicates him directly in the hotel itself, like as a part of the hotel, because Jack is specifically talking almost to the hotel as a result of talking to these ghosts. And so people have debated whether it was really him going mad or whether it's ghosts. But if you pay attention to the scene where he gets out of the pantry, ghosts are actually the explanation or the implied explanation for how he escapes the storeroom. Because Kubrick has stated throughout the whole movie, it allowed you to suspend your doubt of the supernatural until you were so thoroughly into the story that you could accept it almost without noticing. It's not until Grady, the ghost of the former caretaker, slides open the bolt of the larger door, allowing Jack to escape, that you're left with no other explanation but the supernatural. So in the movie, the final straw that actually breaks the camel's back and shows you that the whole events of the movie have been because of something supernatural is when Jack is released by the ghost of Grady. And speaking of Grady, I had mentioned earlier that when the owner of the hotel had brought up Grady before, he had called him Charles Grady. Yet when Jack is approached by this butler in the movie, his name is Delbert Grady. So there's actually some symbolism behind the reason that Grady gives himself two different names. So the name change is almost a mirror of Jack being both a husband and father to Danny and Wendy, and then this mysterious man who's in the 4th of July photo at the end of the film, who is also a spitting image of Jack Torrance. So in essence, he is these two people. One is the man who has this choice and he's in this perilous situation, but he still has the ability to turn around and change what happens. And then there's this man who's always been at the Overlook and will always choose the Overlook when it comes down to it. So if you watch the movie, Jack has a number of moments where he can actually act other than the way he does. He can choose a different path for himself. But these poor choices that are fueled by his weakness and his one example is when he finally decides to drink again. These moments of weakness is what the Overlook uses to take him over and finally twist him into this creature. A part permanently stays at the hotel, like Delbert. So if we were to examine Delbert and Charles Grady, there's going to be a part that permanently stays at the hotel, which is Delbert Grady, the butler who comes up to him in the bathroom. And then there's a part which is the man who's given the choice of whether he actually wants to join the legacy of the Overlook Hotel and who has these options and these chances to turn around and go back or choose a different path. And this is Charles Grady. He entered this job with the best intentions, had no idea what he was getting himself into, but I guarantee down his path of insanity, he had times where he could turn around and do something different and change his path. So Jack in the photo at the end of the movie has always been at the Overlook. Jack is the caretaker, but Jack the caretaker actually chooses to become part of the hotel. So it's an interesting way of looking at this sort of dichotomy between these two characters. Also, the reason that Stephen King also did not like the movie is because there are several scenes in the movie that are different than in the novel. And I've seen both. I've seen the movie and I've read the novel. And while the film is magnificent, I really do like reading the novel. And if you like to read, I suggest reading the novel because the ending is completely different. And a lot of the actual beginning of the story and the structure and how it's built up is completely different. So in the novel, in the movie, the ghost motive is to sort of reclaim Jack, who's this reincarnation of this previous caretaker. And Jack has repeated claims that he's got a feeling that's just like it's not deja vu, it's more than that. And the film is more focused on Jack than in the novel. The novel actually focuses more on Danny and his ability of telepathy and this extra sense. And this is really what the spirits in the hotel are after. They're really focused on Danny because he sort of he shines. He radiates this energy off of him that they can not help but sense. The ghosts in the film kind of show some interest in him, but not as nearly as much as in the novel. So the room number in the novel over the room that Danny's attacked in is actually 217 instead of 237. The Timberline Lodge had a room 217, but they were afraid that after filming, people wouldn't want to stay in the room. And so they asked Kubrick to set up a fake room 237 that they could use for filming. And actually, after the film came out, and still somewhat today, the room 217 at the Timberline Lodge is actually the most requested room at the hotel. Jack's character in the novel is, he's presented more like a like an everyman. He's pretty much liked by everyone, and he's well intentioned, but he's haunted by his past, and he's had these brushes with alcoholism, and he's had some run-ins with authority. And at the novel's conclusion, the hotel is actually completely possessed and destroyed what used to be Jack, to the point that when Jack is going to kill Danny and Wendy in the novel, it stops saying Jack said and it starts saying the hotel said. So at this point, Jack's character in the novel is actually completely gone and he's been overtaken by the hotel. The film shows Jack as kind of sinister already. Maybe that's just because Jack Nicholson sort of gives off that air when he comes on screen. But it showed him as somewhat already on the edge and then just falling deeper into something more evil. And Kubrick also prolonged Jack's writer's block more in the movie because and added the, as I said before, added the all work, no play scene. In the novel, Jack actually finds a scrapbook while checking the hotel's boiler. And then this sort of gets him out of his writer's block because he gets all these new ideas for his novel by seeing these pictures. And this, again, is meant to reinforce the fact that Jack's been here before, or that part of him is sort of with this hotel. And it also speeds up that process of possession that the ghosts use to overtake Jack. Danny in the book is actually more open about his psychic abilities, and he discusses it with people he hasn't even met. And he actually asks his doctor about it when the doctor comes to see him after his first trance. In the film, he's a lot more secretive. Even when Halloran talks to him through this telepathy ability, he's really quiet. And Halloran actually talks in the novel. He frequently talks to others using this telepathy ability. Danny in the novel is actually seen as really intelligent, unusually intelligent for his age. He's around 6. And in the movie, he's just seen around an average kid. And another thing that was also really missing from the movie, and that Stephen King again was not happy about, was the relationship between Danny and Jack was much closer in the book. And that's why it was such a shocking turn of events when, one, Jack, as a result of his alcoholism, dislocates Danny's arm, and two, Jack eventually sets out to try and kill Danny because the two of them were so close. It's insane to see that this hotel has just completely corrupted this man. So that was a key part that was really missing from the movie. And in the novel, it actually shows that Tony, this other part of Danny or this alter ego that comes out in the movie, it sort of represents these hidden parts of Danny's psyche, and they become heavily amplified because of his telepathic abilities. And so it almost completely takes on a new part of himself. And in the ending of the novel, it's actually revealed that Danny's middle name is Anthony. So that's sort of where Tony comes from. Another thing that Stephen King was also not happy about was Wendy Torrance. In the film, she's seen as this meek and passive character and very skittish. And she defends Jack to the doctor when she asks about, you know, has there been any abuse? She's like, oh, no, nothing. And in the novel, she's really self-reliant and independent. And one of the main reasons she's really with Jack is because she's got a poor relationship with her parents. And Jack was really there for her when that happened as a couple. And in the novel, she also remains really resilient and calm as these events are taking place. Whereas in the movie, Shelley Duvall is hysterical and almost completely losing her mind herself. So it's really different. And Stephen King was really upset with the fact that the character he wrote in the book transferred almost not at all onto film. Their family dynamic, Stephen King wanted to provide the reader with information about the stress in the Torrance family early on in the story. So he established Jack's dislocation of Danny's arm really early. The fact that Wendy really feared these mysterious trance spells that Danny would get into. They talk about even before they head out to Colorado, they're at their house and she's seeing him just sit in their front yard, and she's worried about it. And they also give a really in-depth background onto the event that had Jack fired from his last job, where the student had come up to him and they had gotten in that altercation. And then Kubrick tones down their early family tension so that as you watch the movie, their family just sort of gradually breaks down. It's not so much this family that's kind of on the rocks. It's just some real quick backstory and then gradually bringing them down. So it's a lot different in the movie. Danny actually has a strong, as I said before, Danny has a stronger bond with Wendy in the film. And this kind of inspires Jack to think that they're plotting against him. So it only works for the film to help Jack release his anger out on them. It only makes him more enraged and more of this animal. And so there's also, as I said before, the ending in the novel is almost completely different. So in the novel, there's this boiler that has to be checked every day because if you don't, it can overheat and then explode. And so what happens is in the novel, when Jack is busy chasing down Wendy and Danny, he forgets to check the boiler. So Jack, now possessed by the hotel, is rushing down to get to the boiler, and that lets Wendy and Danny escape. And the ending is actually he gets to the boiler and tries to turn it down, and it appears to go down, and then the boiler explodes and actually destroys the hotel, which I think is a better ending. In terms of Stephen King, Stephen King is almost like Quentin Tarantino, where you don't really get a happy ending, you just get an ending. And sometimes it can really make you upset because you want a happy ending every now and then. And this was a perfect example of Stephen King giving a happy ending. So also in the novel, there was an maze. There were these large topiary animals, these animals, you know, cut out of hedges. And later in the story, Dick Halloran, when he's coming to help rescue them, these topiary animals actually come to life and attack him and hurt him pretty bad. And he's able to light them on fire using an extra gas tank from the snowmobile or snow cat that he was using. And he's eventually able to make it to the hotel, where he's injured by Jack. But Jack actually doesn't kill Dick Halloran in the novel. In the novel, he actually recovers from his wounds and is able to escape with Wendy and Danny before the hotel explodes. And the reason that they really couldn't use these topiary animals is just they didn't have the special effects technology at the time to do the scene. And so they had to rewrite the ending. And unfortunately, that ending resulted in Scatman Crothers' character being killed. The hotel in the movie is... The reason it has this energy and this dark force around it is supposed to be from being built over this Native American burial ground and the Native Americans being angry with that. And so there's this negative energy that's all over the property. And in the novel, the hotel's power is actually from all these evil actions and evil memories that have taken place there. There were people murdered. There was a gang shootout in the top penthouse of the presidential suite, I believe, actually, of the hotel. So there's just this dark, dark past, not even including Grady when he watched the hotel and killed his family. That's just one of the many stories in this hotel. So this hotel, because of all the evil things that have happened there, it absorbs this evil and then manifests it as these ghosts and as these entities. And it's just this malevolent force that is the hotel. It's not all these ghosts living in the hotel, undead living in the hotel. It's the hotel itself sort of combining this energy into one and then funneling it out into different characters throughout the movie, Grady and other subsequent ghosts that they encounter as they stay at the hotel. And then some of the film's most iconic scenes, such as the blood coming out of the elevator and then the two girl ghosts standing in the hallway, are actually very unique to the film. Those are specific to the film in general. So tonight, that'll end us on here on the premiere. I definitely guarantee you watch that movie and explore any other horror movies, even if you aren't a horror fan. It's fun to watch one every now and again just to scare yourself. So that'll be it here for the premiere. I'm DJ Jazz, and you were listening to Penguin Radio.